Welcome all, and especially welcome to those just arriving today. The venerable practice leaders all here today. It's rarely we manage to bring us all together. We decided a long time ago, let's pick one day where we all sit together, and this is it. And Kogetsu, great to see you after a long time. And we're gathered here on Vulture Peak to explore the wondrous Dharma Lotus Flower Sutra. Partly because it's in our chant book, and of all the chants that we chant sometimes, this one I've heard the most kind of questionable feedback about this Lotus Sutra's lifespan of the Tathagata that we chant. Some people feel like, it doesn't resonate with everyone. I've heard some people say, it sounds so theistic. I confess, I think it does sound kind of theistic. I think early Buddhism is clearly non-theistic, but Mahayana Buddhism, dances a fine line between a non-theism and theism, depending on how we define these terms, I think. And also, I'm appreciating talking about this chapter because it seems very, very central and dear to our particular Soto Zen lineage. Dogen Zenji in his Shobogenzo quotes and comments on this particular chapter 16 of the Lotus Sutra in 10 different Shobogenzo essays. That's like not just a random mention. He quotes a lot of other Lotus Sutra chapters too. I think it's fair to say that the Lotus Sutra was the most important scripture for Dogen Zenji. And because he grew up in the Tendai tradition of Japan, of which this Lotus Sutra is the central scripture. And Dogen loved the Lotus Sutra so much that in the 10 names of Buddha that we chant at meal times, if you count them, there's actually 11 names because Dogen added the Lotus Sutra as a name of Buddha. Homage to the Saddharma Pundarika Sutra. Nam-myoho-renge-kyo, Nam-myoho-renge-kyo, Nam-myoho-renge-kyo. That homage to the Lotus Sutra mantra is the central recitation practice of the Nichiren school, and shuffling through Wikipedia, I was surprised to see that Nam-myoho-renge-kyo means homage to the wondrous Dharma Lotus Flower Sutra is like, there's all these pop references, like whole stream of like, in all these movies that the title of the Lotus Sutra is appearing. My favorite, I didn't look in, none of them were like super popular movies, but somebody collected all these top references to Nam-myoho Renge-kyo. And my favorite on that list was the monkeys. Does anyone know
the monkeys?
Was like a kind of, it was a 60s TV show that was like about this, kind of a comedy about this bumbling band called Hey Hey with the Monkeys. That was kind of...
We didn't think they were bumbling.
We thought they were like as good as the Beatles.
They were cool. They were, I think, definitely a Beatles spin-off.
Yeah, about like a year.
Yeah, but according to Wikipedia...
They weren't even actual musicians, so...
Maybe not, yeah. But apparently in the very last episode of The Monkees, one of the monkeys was like stuck in some sort of trance, and the way that his friends got him out of the trance was to say Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, homage to the Saddharma Pundarika Sutra. So, well, we could probably find it on YouTube somewhere, right? This episode.
A word for the monkey. One of them was Michael Nesmith, who was a real musician.
Oh, okay. Maybe wrote some of their songs.
Did you? Very possibly was the one that threw that in.
Oh, okay. Right, yeah. Tina Turner may be the most famous Nam-myoho Renge-kyo reciter. Apparently she was on the brink of suicide at one point and started chanting homage to the Wondrous Dharma Lotus Flower Sutra, and her life totally turned around. So...
Tina?
Tina Turner.
And that's depicted in a movie.
No, yeah, a movie about her.
Her life.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Shows that
oh, interesting.
Yeah, her
okay.
Graphics
mm-hmm. Her yeah. So, the Lotus Sutra. Mm-hmm. Miraculous powers of the Lotus Sutra. In our tradition, this is probably not the case anywhere in America. In fact, I don't know of any Soto Zen temples in America besides Warm Jewel Temple where they ever chant Chapter 16 of the Lotus Sutra. There probably are some. Maybe Diane Benage, I think she might chant this because she's kind of like trained in Japan. But in Japan, every Soto Zen temple, at least where they're doing, you know, morning service, morning and evening services, and this verse from Chapter 16 of the Lotus Sutra is chanted every day. The Lotus Sutra's lifespan of the Tathagata verse that we chant. It's a daily chant. And there's another verse from celebrating Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva that's also chanted daily at morning service in Soto Zen temples. So it seems like these sections of the Lotus Sutra are like the centerpiece. And I don't think this is not something coming from Dogen. This is Juri, considered the founder of the Tiantai school in China in the 6th century. Placed the Lotus Sutra as the kind of central teaching of the Tiantai tradition, of which Zen kind of, you know, mixed with in China and Japan. And he, Juri, said that this chapter 16 is like the kind of the center, the heart of the Lotus Sutra. And this verse is like the heart of the chapter. So the part that we chanted this morning is like the essence of the Lotus Sutra, according to Juri and many others after him. This inconceivable lifespan of the Tathagata is the central theme of the sutra. There's a lot of other amazingly wonderful stuff in the sutra that we talked about the last couple of days a little bit. This is just reviewing a little bit for those arriving. I also heard that Juri, this founder of the Tiantai school in China, define the Trikaya, the three bodies of Buddha, which is an important Mahayana teaching, and it can be kind of confusing and hard to understand, and it's presented many different ways, but one simple way that he presented these three Buddha bodies is the Dharmakaya, we could say the truth body, the reality body of Buddha is simply truth or reality itself. It's the definition of Buddha's Dharma body is the reality of, we could say, emptiness, non-duality, Buddha nature, depending on various ways of talking about the ultimate truth. But the truth itself, whether or not anyone realizes it, the Dharmakaya is beginningless and endlessly present. And the Sambhogakaya, meaning like the enjoyment body of Buddha, is defined by Jiri as the realization of this truth. The realization or the knowing of the Dharmakaya, you could say, of emptiness. So that's, so therefore the Sambhogakaya, there can be a knowing that was never known before. So in a way we say Sambhogakaya isn't exactly beginningless and endless. There can be a moment of recognizing and understanding the ultimate truth. And then, if it's, you know, complete with the depth of a Buddha, then that Sambhogakaya becomes endless. It doesn't ever disappear, but it kind of has a beginning, right? Whereas the Dharmakaya has no beginning or end. You could say the Sambhogakaya has a beginning but no end. And then the Nirmanakaya is the compassionate expression of the realization of truth in the world for the benefit of beings. So you could say the Nirmanakaya is a particular arising of compassion and expression, usually as a human being or some being or even some thing. Sometimes they even try to stretch this idea of Nirmanakaya to include like anything that benefits beings at all. So like a bridge to cross the water could be like a manifestation of Buddha to help beings. I don't know if the bridges over the San Lorenzo River are Nirmanakayas. We could open to that possibility, that they're kind of manifestations of this realization of reality expressing itself compassionately for all beings. So Nirmanakaya is like Shakyamuni Buddha, who was born at Lumbini, and entered the way at Bodh Gaya and taught at Varanasi and entered Parinirvana in Kushinagara. He was like, had a beginning and had an end. This is how it seems to me now. Dharmakaya seems like it has no beginning and end. Sambhogakaya seems like it has a beginning but then no end. And Nirmanakaya has a beginning and an end. And you see how the three fit together. In a way you could say first is Dharmakaya, just the reality of as it is. And then Sambhogakaya is realizing that, knowing that, an awareness that knows truth. And then Nirmanakaya is the compassionate expression of knowing the truth. So I thought it was a nice, simple way of talking about three bodies of Buddha. And based on this model, the Jiri, and I think he may be basing this on Vasubandhu's teaching. Vasubandhu, one of our Indian ancestors, is supposedly wrote the only presently abiding Sanskrit, you know, Indian commentary on the Wondrous Dharma Lotus Flower Sutra. There might have been other Indian commentaries on, probably were, on this amazing sutra, but the only one we have left in Sanskrit is Vasubandhu's commentary. Some people say it might not actually be Vasubandhu, but it's attributed to Vasubandhu in Indian commentary. And talking about chapter 16 that we're talking about today, Vasubandhu talks about this chapter in terms of these three bodies. So I think Jiri does the same. And since Jiri lived later, he was probably influenced by this. So they say that the Dharmakaya, as presented in chapter 16, in this chapter the Buddha says, nothing is as it seems, nor is it otherwise. And the three realms are not really the way we experience them. All possible realms of sentient beings are not the way that we humans experience them. We talked about that earlier in Sesshin, it's in chapter 16. And so Vasubandhu says that that's the Dharmakaya. That's Buddha's reality body, is that things are not as they seem, nor are they other, something opposite than the way that they seem. It's completely ungraspable how things are. But reality is not the way that we sentient beings with dualistic consciousness are perceiving it. That not the way it appears is the Dharmakaya, according to Vasubandhu. And the Sambhogakaya is this inconceivable lifespan of the Buddha. Like our chant says, since I attained Buddhahood, the number of kalpas that have passed is incalculable, hundreds, thousands, myriads, and billions of long eons. That is a statement of the Sambhogakaya. Because notice how it's a long, 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 long time. But the Buddha, it is a certain number of kalpas. It's an inconceivable number of kalpas, but it doesn't say beginninglessly, primordially. Or strictly speaking, the sutra says it's just been uncountable, inconceivable numbers of eons since I attained Buddhahood. And so because of that, Vasubandhu says, this is like the Sambhogakaya that began with a certain realization, this realization of Buddhahood a long time ago. And it may go on forever now. And then the Nirmanakaya, in chapter 16, the Buddha says, for those who prefer, lesser teachings, but we might say like simpler or like easier to deal with teachings. I taught that I was born at Lumbini and I sat under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya and realized the way, and and I did these various things in my life, and I'm going to enter Parinirvana in Kushinagara. For those who feel like this inconceivable lifespan is too much, I teach this other way too. And Vasubandhu says, that's the Nirmanakaya. It's very helpful for people who need to hear it like that. A more conventional story. But Buddha is kind of saying, it's kind of a story that I told about my life. This human 80-year lifespan is kind of like, it's a skillful means story to help people. That's kind of a central theme of this chapter of the Lotus Sutra. The Buddha says in the Lotus Sutra, those who are sincere and trusting, honest and upright, with gentle intention, wholeheartedly, which also is in Japanese, ishin, so could translate as with one mind, wishing to see the Buddha, in Japanese, kenbutsu. Here it says, wishing to behold the Buddha, is kenbutsu, which is the name of a Shobogenzo chapter by Dogen, in which he gets into this stuff. And so the sutra says, those with one mind wishing to see the Buddha, not begrudging their own bodily lives, then I and the assembled Sangha appeared together on sacred Vulture Peak. And then Dogen, commenting on these lines, says, this one mind, you could say wholeheartedness, or one mind, is Vulture Peak. This, by the way, is Vulture Peak. So we can sit together today at the foot of Vulture Peak. This thing here that in humans might call like made of stone, this, you know, stone, this particular formation of stone, I think was probably on Vulture Peak before 2,500 years ago when Shakyamuni Buddha taught on Vulture Peak in his Nirmanakaya form. So the top of Vulture Peak is not much bigger than the Zendo here, actually. Maybe twice the size. The flat area where you can stop and enjoy the 360-degree view. So when Buddha taught the Lotus Sutra and the Heart Sutra on Vulture Peak, I propose that this stone received face-to-face transmission from Shakyamuni Buddha on Vulture Peak because it was within 20 yards of Shakyamuni Buddha's face. This is just like, now we're just talking rationally in the world of things and time and space. This rock must have seen Shakyamuni Buddha teaching the Lotus Sutra, and Shakyamuni Buddha must have included this rock in his field of vision. So that transmission is also timeless. So especially with the blessing of this physical piece of Vulture Peak with us, Shakyamuni Buddha's Lotus Sutra is, if we're really quiet, we can almost like hear it kind of like ringing in the particles of stone. It never stops. So Dogen says, commenting on this wholehearted or this one mind is Vulture Peak. This one mind is Vulture Peak. One mind is no other than Vulture Peak. One mind here today is Vulture Peak, and this Vulture Peak is one mind. This is, all of us are part of this event. Dogen says, How can one body not come forth together with one mind? to see Buddha is Vulture Peak, Dogen says, and it is the assembled Sangha appear together. So, the assembled Sangha is us together as Vulture Peak, as one mind. So this is kind of Dogen's joyful play with the Lotus Sutra, chapter 16. Yes.
Tenshin Roshi would take assembled sanghas, temporary sanghas, up to the Suzuki Roshi Memorial in Tassajara, which is another peak with another stone, a boulder, which I believe Tenshin Roshi told us Suzuki Roshi indicated one day as perhaps the right kind of stone to place on such a peak. And I wonder, could we say that similarly, right there at the Suzuki Roshi Memorial, when we assemble with as one body, we are also experiencing something of what you have just
very much so
described?
Yes, and we could say that that Tassajara stone had direct face-to-face transmission with Shunryu Suzuki Roshi.
Yes.
And Suzuki Roshi had face-to-face transmission with that very stone. Therefore, in the realm of timelessness, that transmission is still taking place, which means Suzuki Roshi is really that stone. And we, the assembled Sangha on Tassajara Peak, with one mind, are that stone and are Suzuki Roshi and are Tassajara and are here too now. Yeah, inconceivable unity is sometimes sounds absurd, but some of us wholeheartedly wish to see the Buddha. So we're like, it's okay if it sounds absurd. I'm willing to open to absurdity in order to see the Buddha. I feel that way. So this sutra goes on. Other lands contain living beings reverent with faith aspiring. Among them as well, I give voice to Supreme Dharma. So I think he's saying, not just Vulture Peak in India, but other lands contain living beings, right? Reverent with faith aspiring, among them as well, I give voice to Supreme Dharma. You who do not hear this, only suppose I am passed into extinction, referring to cessation of parinirvana. The Sanskrit of the sutra actually says nirvana there. But I don't like translating so much this word metsu in Japanese as, or nirodha in Sanskrit, as extinction, because I can't help thinking about dinosaurs. The Buddha is not extinct. It's just a funny way of talking, but it's a pretty popular translation of these terms in English. I would maybe just say cessation. Nirodha really means cessation, and metsu also. You think I have totally ceased, which is the Buddha's early teaching. Parinirvana was like complete cessation is parinirvana. There's no more nothing of Shakyamuni Buddha, which was considered in early Buddhism like the supreme goal, is no more nothing. But this is, I think, a big shift. Maybe one of the main one of the main shifts between the foundational teachings and the great vehicle, the Mahayana, is the foundational teachings were really into, like, we want to end everything. It had a kind of, cessation is like the most amazing, greatest thing ever. The Mahayana is like, well, actually, like, you know, being is pretty good too. Ever-presentness is also maybe even better than cessation. Eternally benefiting beings as bodhisattvas is even better than ceasing completely. This is part of this Mahayana shift. You do not hear this, only suppose I am passed into this complete cessation. I behold living beings drowning in the sea of suffering. Hence I do not reveal myself. Reveal here is this Japanese, in the Kumarajiva's classic translation of the Lotus Sutra, it's this term gen, as in genjo koan. So manifest, actualize, we could translate it as. Hence I do not manifest myself, but I set all these beings to yearning, to aspiring, to when their hearts are filled with longing, I then emerge and proclaim the Dharma. With such pervasive spiritual power for uncountable kalpas, I abide on sacred Vulture Peak and every other dwelling place. So, the Buddha manifests parinirvana in order to encourage us to practice, which we talked about this a little past days. Like, it seems kind of funny. You'd think the Buddha would manifest his presence to encourage us, but instead he manifests disappearing to encourage us. But in the sutra, the Buddha puts it as like, when they think the Buddha's gone forever, the disciples grieve. They start grieving, and in their grief, they kind of like snap out of some confusion and say, "We should take the medicine that the Buddha left us, that we've just not wanted to bother taking till now." So this is something like the principle. There's a nice book I haven't finished reading here called Emptiness and Omnipresence, An Essential Introduction to Chantai Buddhism by a modern American scholar, practitioner of Chantai Buddhism, which is not so popular in America. But this is a friend of Taigen, Brooke Zipperin. Taigen thinks this book is like the best. It's very accessible. It's a kind of a practice orientation, but a lot about the Lotus Sutra. So in this book, in this chapter on talking about this inconceivable lifespan of the Buddha, and this thing of the Buddha appearing to enter parinirvana to benefit us, Brooke Zipperin says, "His absence is a mode of his presence. His effectiveness in the world, his being here with his children, he is more there for," this is referring to this parable of a doctor who is prescribing medicine for his children and they don't take it. But the parable is referring to the doctor as the Buddha. So sometimes we could say the Buddha is more there for his disciples when he's not there. For being there to someone, being present to them, really just means the power to have an effect on them. being there for someone means. The power to influence someone is what being there for them means. And it is the Buddha's absence that makes them search for him, long for him, and in this way become intensely focused on him, feeling his effect that much more deeply. In fact, both being there and not being there are alternate modes of being there, of doing Buddha work in the world. You follow that? That sometimes the Buddha appears to benefit beings as a Buddha, and sometimes the Buddha disappears and enters parinirvana, which we're going to memorialize in a ceremony today. A little bit of a sad ceremony, kind of, because Shakyamuni Buddha, in his nirmanakaya form, is no longer with us. But I appreciated this part, that the Buddha's absence is a mode of his presence, because being there to someone, being present to them, really just means the power to have an effect on them. In other words, not being there is relational. Is the fact that Buddha entered parinirvana and is not here is a type of relationship with us. I mean, it's kind of obvious, right? We have a relationship with Shakyamuni Buddha for a long time. We've heard about him, and we've heard about his parinirvana, and that's having an effect on us. And if he was still living in the world as a human, that would be a different kind of effect on us. So, something like that. Presence can be beneficial, and absence can be beneficial. But it seems like a theme of this chapter is this wholeheartedly, with one mind, wishing to see the Buddha. And here it's expressed as, I set them all to yearning or aspiring, to when their hearts are filled with longing for the Buddha, then I emerge and proclaim the Dharma. So there's something about the Buddha is in relationship to us, and when we long to see the Buddha, when we aspire and really wish to see the Buddha, then the Buddha comes. And if we don't long to see the Buddha or aspire to see the Buddha, maybe the Buddha like holds back a little, like, well, they don't really need me right now. My late great teacher in Japan, Abbot of Bukokuji, Harada Tongen Roshi, used to say somewhat regularly, those who set out to realize it, we might say, who aspire, who long to realize it, will definitely realize it without a doubt. And those who do not set out to realize it, who don't aspire to realize it, definitely will not realize it without a doubt. That one is one of his sayings that really stuck with me. I think interesting. In other words, well, just kind of like sit around and come up and wait for Buddha to come and offer himself, herself to us. But now it seems like there's something about, I really wish to see the Buddha, to realize Buddha. And then Buddha's like, oh, okay. Then, if you want to play, I'll play with you. Now, there's maybe a danger in here that we call gaining idea. Right? We might try to, I really want to get something here. I really want to get Buddha, and I want to see Buddha. And if we're kind of, if we, maybe part of the gaining idea would be is we're kind of reifying our separate self that's trying to get something for itself. And we're also maybe reifying Buddha, like, I know there's some Buddha, like, in this general direction, so I'm going to go this direction. Whereas maybe this yearning for Buddha, to see Buddha, when Buddha really comes, is when we're really open to, I don't actually know how Buddha's going to come. I don't have a fixed idea of what that's going to look like. If we're thinking it's going to look like a 16-foot golden body with a hair curl between his eyes, radiating a light beam right into my forehead, then, well, it might not look like that. And that kind of limits it. But if we say, I just wish to see the Buddha and I don't know how the Buddha wants to teach me or reveal himself to me, I'm open to any way Buddha comes, but I really do want to meet Buddha, then Buddha could come in all kinds of surprising ways, which I think is part of the Zen style of yearning for Buddha, that sometimes when the Zen ancestors were asked, well, what is Buddha actually? They would say, well, it's like kind of dried up toilet paper. So it's kind of like surprising. So if it's not like a 16-foot golden body. But if we really wish to see the Buddha in any form and we're really open, then maybe seeing this pile of dried up toilet paper, which we sometimes see such things, we might actually see Buddha. We might see Buddha if we're really open. Yes.
I'm thinking that maybe the fourth vow, Buddha's way is unsurpassable, about to be come yet.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We encourage the dropping away of the gaining.
Yes.
We have some kind of fixed idea somewhere, and this, that is just wide open.
Yeah. I want to be Buddha.
Yeah.
See Buddha is a little interesting. For those of you who are here in Rohatsu Sesshin, we heard about the Dogen was really not into this word Kensho for awakening. Kensho means seeing nature. Seeing Buddha nature. And the implication is that we felt like that's a little dualistic to talk about something that we're going to see. So he didn't like this term Kensho, but he wrote a whole essay called Kenbutsu. Kensho, you could even expand it to say Kenbusho, seeing Buddha nature. He didn't like that, but he liked Kenbutsu. And I think the way you can read the essay, it's not about seeing something, actually, but he was... Maybe it was his sort of like the people he was practicing with, like, why don't you ever talk about Kensho, Dogen? He's like, well, I'm not going to do that because you guys are too obsessed about that term. But secretly, I'm going to write an essay called Kenbutsu. Then, Buddha goes on, when living beings see the kalpas and kalpas, aeon, when they see the kalpas end with all consumed in a great blaze, my domain stays serene and calm, ever filled with human and heavenly beings, gardens and groves, pavilions and palaces, adorned with every kind of gem and jeweled trees, lush with flowers and fruit, where living beings delight and play. So, there's a whole tradition of Pure Land Buddhism, most popularly known through Amitabha's Pure Land, where the, which is described kind of like this celestial kind of realm with gardens and groves, pavilions and palaces adorned with gems and beings frolicking and playing, like a blissful realm. Sukhavati, Amitabha's Pure Land, means the blissful realm, happy land. And this is interesting because it's in the Lotus Sutra, it's Shakyamuni Buddha's Pure Land, described in this kind of classic Pure Land kind of way. Although it is interesting that it says, my Pure Land, that always stays serene and calm, is filled with human and heavenly beings. Yeah, Amitabha's pure land is when humans die, they can vow to be born there, and they're born from lotus flowers in Amitabha's land. So they're not really like humans there. So there's a little twist. In Shakyamuni's pure land, it's filled with human beings. And Vimalakirti, in his sutra, has a chapter on pure lands, or Buddha fields. Buddha Kshetra is the Sanskrit for pure land, Buddha land. Where he says, Bodhisattvas, pure lands, or Buddha fields, are fields of sentient beings. So this is another kind of like twist of non-duality, that these pure lands where there's no more human suffering and birth and death, Vimalakirti says, actually Bodhisattva's pure lands are, or Buddha fields, are fields of sentient beings, of ordinary humans, sentient beings. And we could say that reality of these sentient beings is this pure suchness. So we could say we are in a pure land now, but we often don't appreciate that. So Dogen, commenting on this this phrase, well, let me finish the rest of the paragraph about this pure land. The heavenly beings beat celestial drums, ever making pleasing music, showering white mandala flowers over Buddha and the great assembly. My pure land, in Japanese, my Jodo is the name of the pure land school. My pure land is not destroyed, yet all view it as ravaged by fire, so that fear and distress pervade everywhere. And it strikes me, reading this now, is in contemporary times, that something seems so true about this, right? That when we see the end of a certain period, Kalpa's end, but we maybe are seeing like the end of a certain kind of like mode of life on Earth in some ways. Earth is always changing, but big changes we know are happening these days, right? Species are going extinct way faster than they ever have before. So it's kind of like this ending was all consumed in a great blaze. The whole continent of Australia, still being consumed in great blaze. Yeah. So it's something that somehow is like pertinent, that there's blazing fires going on in this world, and a lot of things are ending. It's like something's being demonstrated to us. But the Buddha, very radically, if we really think about our current situation, Buddha says, my domain, my land, my Buddha Kshetra, it says in Sanskrit, my Buddha field, stays serene and calm, ever filled with human and heavenly beings. And then later, he says here, yeah, my pure land is not destroyed, yet all view it as ravaged by fire, so that fear and distress pervade everywhere. There is a lot of fear and distress going on in this world. So we might wonder about this kind of teaching. I think there's maybe I could imagine a lot of people might hear this kind of teaching and say, like, that's not the kind of practice thing I want to practice in that realm of, like, yeah, there's this pure land that's totally serene when the world is going down in flames. And since it's not destroyed, we'll be fine. Some people might not like that kind of teaching. I can imagine that someone's like, it doesn't matter what we do here in this messy planet, because in the heavens afterwards we'll be fine. Some might hear it like that and feel like, well, then it could be an excuse to not care about this world. I think that could be the problem with this type of teaching. So I think we just have to consider really deeply, what does this mean? Is the Buddha's pure land that's his domain that always stays serene and calm when the fires are destroying everything? Is that some place that people go after they die? I think that may be not so helpful. That might be lead to some apathy in this world. But what if this pure land is not some other place? What if it's actually right here on Vulture Peak? One mind is Vulture Peak. One mind is Santa Cruz. There's one Buddha field of sentient beings. And how can we find the serenity and peace that's always present, that cannot be destroyed, as the kind of the essence, the heart of this suffering world? And I think that is actually how the Pure Land School, at least my understanding of the Japanese Jodo, Jodo Shu, the Pure Land School of Japan, doesn't, they will maybe talk about Amitabha's Pure Land as also a place after we leave this life. But my understanding is that in a more non-dual way, they say the Pure Land is actually right here. It's actually the reality of this present world. But it's hard to see that. We need a lot of wholehearted devotion and wishing to see the Buddha, to open to this, the peacefulness of the blazing fires. So Dogen, in his Shobogenzo essay, Lotus Flowers, Turning Lotus Flowers, quotes this line, especially the part, ever filled with human and heavenly beings. He emphasizes this Buddha's Pure Land is ever filled with human and heavenly beings. And he says, this is the land of Shakyamuni Buddha and Vairochana Buddha. He throws in there, which is part of the whole Tendai tradition. It's called the eternal land of silent light. The silent light pure land, Dogen says. And that's because that's from the Lotus Sutra. And the final, called repentance chapter of the Lotus Sutra, Shakyamuni Buddha says, I have this pure land called tranquil, light, silent, luminescence. Dogen says, ever filled with human and heavenly beings is Shakyamuni Buddha's Buddha field, and it's called the eternal land of silent light. Dogen says, encompassing, and then he mentions some other Tiantai tradition pure lands. We could just say encompassing all pure lands or Buddha fields. Within ourselves, we abide in the Buddha land of one suchness. We abide in the pure land of one suchness, encompassing all pure lands, including Amitabhas and Shakyamunis, and all Buddha fields, encompassing them all within ourself. We abide in the Buddha field, the pure land of one suchness, which is also called silent light, pure land. Why is it called silent light, pure land? We've also been talking this session about Thomas Nagel, the American philosopher, who wrote this seminal essay that I was amazed that some people know of in the assembly. called What Is It Like to Be a Bat? And so I went afterwards and kind of looked into this Thomas Nagel. In the 70s, he wrote this essay. He says, an organism, like a bat, has conscious mental states if and only if there is something that it is like to be that organism, something it is like for that organism. I think that's the central statement of this essay. An organism, let's say, in Buddhist language, a sentient being, a human, a bat, a sentient being has conscious mental states if and only if there is something that it's like to be this sentient being, something it's like for this sentient being. So it's a funny language. It's what it is likeness. If there's something it's like to be alive, there's something it's like to be aware, there's something it's like to be a human and a sentient being. And somewhere along the line, the Buddhists picked up on this Thomas Nagel essay. And so this is maybe paraphrasing some of like Mark Sideritz and some other Buddhist scholar practitioners talking about reflexive awareness. Reflexive, by the way, in Webster's dictionary means reflexive with an X, means directed or turned back on itself. That's the definition of reflexive. So reflexive awareness is directed or turned back on itself. Yeah, so it's a great term, I think. In English, reflexive awareness is a particular phenomena that is part of Mahayana Buddhism. Awareness is always aware of itself. There, which is another way we could say this, is there is something it is like to be aware, using Thomas Nagel's language. There is something it's like to be experiencing. This what it is likeness is created by the reflexivity of awareness. And this is this what it is likeness, or reflexive awareness, is the difference between a sentient being and a mere color detection mechanism, or like a robot, for example. You could build a robot that's more intelligent than a human, can compute things faster, can act. They have robots like this, right? That are almost you can't tell the difference between a human. They can think, they can respond to things that you say. Everything's programmed in. They look like a human. They act like a human. But for this robot, there's not something it is like to be a robot. That's the difference that the Buddhists are saying. You could never build artificial awareness, reflexive awareness. It's unconstructed. So I invite you to consider this phrase, what it is likeness. There's something it's like to be alive and aware. And Dogen says, the eternal land of silent light and all these other pure lands within ourselves is abiding in the Buddha land of one suchness. Maybe very, very simply we could say, the Buddha land of one suchness, tranquil light, pure land, is just what it is like to be alive and aware right now. Suzuki Roshi says in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, in the Marrow of Zen section, he says, the awareness that you are here right now is the ultimate fact. This is the point you will realize by Zazen practice. I think Thomas Nagel would appreciate that, and Dogen too. So, continuing this Lotus Sutra chapter, the beings vexed with their offenses caused by their unwholesome karma through vast rounds of kalpas hear not the name of the three treasures. So some people might feel like, this is, we don't like this, we don't like talking about beings vexed by their offenses and that are like left out. But I think it's just maybe saying, well, there are beings that are greatly affected by the actions that we've done. And so sometimes we don't hear about the three treasures and sometimes we do. And if we in this room have heard about the three treasures, which is the case, then somewhere in our past or childhood, we must have done something good. So Dogen quotes this line, those due to karma hear not the name of the three treasures. Dogen's comment in his essay called Taking Refuge in the Three Treasures, he says, quoting this line, the Lotus Sutra is itself the one great matter's cause and condition. It may be said to be the great sovereign of all sutras. All other sutras are merely its servants. It alone expounds the truth. Other sutras take refuge in the Lotus Sutra. This Dogen's kind of rave about the Lotus Sutra. But those who practice virtuous deeds are gentle, upright, and sincere. These all see that I exist, abiding here, proclaiming Dharma. So there's our practice instructions of this chapter, I think, really. If we want to see the Buddha, wow, what do we practice? Virtuous deeds, gentle, upright, and sincere, and wholeheartedly wishing to see the Buddha. Then such ones do see that I exist, I abide here, proclaiming Dharma. Seeing Buddha chapter, Dogen says, commenting on this line, those who practice virtuous deeds are gentle, upright, and sincere. These all see that I exist, abiding here, proclaiming Dharma. Dogen says, virtuous deeds means splattering mud and getting wet in water, or following waves to chase waves. It's kind of surprising. Virtuous deeds means splattering mud and getting wet in water. So we could hear this as, instead of virtuous deeds means I have to be really, really good and like keep all the precepts perfectly. We do aspire like this, but sometimes it means it's just a big mess. We're willing to live in this messy, messy, muddy world. That's how I would understand Dogen's, virtuous deeds means we're willing to get really muddy here. That's Bodhisattva's virtuous deeds. Splattering mud, getting wet, or following waves to chase waves, which maybe we could see this as the unchanging ocean of Buddha nature has all these waves made of ocean and rising and ceasing, and we get all caught up in these appearing waves, and we're on one wave, chasing another wave, following this wave and that wave, totally distracted by the mud of this world. Virtuous deeds means splattering mud and getting wet in water, or following waves to chase waves. To practice this is called gentle, upright, and sincere, as the sutra says. It's called the gentle, upright, and sincere of you are thus, I am thus too. This is to see Buddha in the mud, to see Buddha with the heart of the waves. This is to encounter Buddha who is, quote, abiding here, proclaiming Dharma. At times, for the sake of that assembly, the sutra says, I describe Buddha's lifespan as immeasurable. For those who after great lengths see Buddha, I explain how rarely Buddha is encountered. Such is the power of my wisdom with beams of insight shining beyond measure. In Sanskrit, prabhasvara. It's really wisdom, light, shining. This lifespan of countless kalpas was gained from long cultivated practice. That's why we say it's not the Dharmakaya isn't gained from practice. The Dharmakaya is always presently, beginninglessly, endlessly the case. But the Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya are realized through long cultivated practice. That's how this lifespan of countless kalpas arose. You who have wisdom in regards to this, entertain no doubts. Cast them off forever ended, for Buddha's words are true, not false. Like the good physician who with skillful means in order to cure his delirious children, although truly alive, spreads word he is dead, yet cannot be charged with falsehood. He's willing to lie to only in order to benefit beings. A skillful means. I too, as parent of the world, savior of all suffering and afflicted, this is the part that sounds kind of theistic. I as parent of the world, savior of all suffering and afflicted, and in Sanskrit it's actually Lokapita Swayambhu, and Lokapita means like father of the world, and Swayambhu means like the self-created one. It's like both of these are apparently pre-Buddhist so-called Hindu terms. Lokapita Swayambhu is like different Hindu deities are called this. So the Lotus Sutra is kind of, this is maybe the most, maybe we could even say a theistic phrase. I am the self-created one. The parent of the world, savior of all suffering and afflicted, for the sake of confused worldly people, although truly living, I am thought to be extinct. For the sake of benefiting confused people, I tell them I enter parinirvana. Because if due to always seeing me, their hearts become selfish and arrogant, dissolute and set on the five desires, craving forms, sounds, smells, tastes, and touches, they would fall into evil destinies, which means the lower realms of hungry ghosts and hells and animals. I always know which beings practice the way and which do not. I've heard some people around here, they don't like that line because it sounds like Santa Claus. We know when if you've been naughty or nice, so be good for goodness sake. So it is a little funny. I always know which beings practice the way and which do not. It really says, in Sanskrit it actually says, I know the course of the world. And in Chinese it actually says, I know sentient beings practicing the way and not practicing the way. So that which is actually not in the original text. It's not so much discriminating these ones and these ones. I just know all sentient beings, and I know there's practicing and not practicing. It's more the spirit. In accord with what their salvation requires, I give voice to the various teachings, ever making this my thought. This is the heart, the summary, the essence of the chapter, which is the essence of the sutra, which is the essence of all the sutras, which are the essence of reality of this life. The final line, ever thinking, constantly thinking, incessantly thinking, without ever stopping thinking. Nen, 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 ju, xin, ki. Ever making this my nen, it says. How can I cause the living beings to enter into the unsurpassed way and promptly embody Buddha? And Dogen comments on that line in Hotsubo Daishin, Arousing Bodhicitta essay. promptly embody Buddha, Dogen says, this is exactly the timeless activity of the Tathagata in his aspiration, practice, and fruit of realization. To benefit sentient beings, this is a kind of Dogen twist here. To benefit sentient beings is to help them arouse the aspiration to awaken other sentient beings before awakening themselves. For us to help sentient beings is to help them arouse the aspiration to help others before themselves. So, I don't know. I appreciate this chapter of the Lotus Sutra after this weekend a little bit more. And if it all seems a little too out there for us Zen folks, we can just sit here at the foot of Vulture Peak. Really, like, you could sum up the whole Lotus Sutra right there. This is the one mind of the Lotus Sutra, the eternally abiding, silent light, pure land, the great assembly appearing together with the Buddha. It's just this Vulture Peak. And as Corrine said yesterday, it rocks. We dedicate the merit of our gathering to gather to explore the wondrous Dharma Lotus Flower Sutra to the complete awakening of all living beings. May they be serene and calm, ever peaceful, abiding in the silent light, pure land, in the very center of the raging flames at the end of the kalpa. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.